TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Hans von Sponeck, lift the sanctions on Iraq. Over 6,000 Iraqis, most of them children, die every month as a result of trade sanctions and ongoing U.S.-British military attacks. Hans von Sponeck resigned in protest from his United Nations position as humanitarian coordinator of the Oil for Food program. He held that job from 1998 to 2000. Against the wishes of his superiors at the Security Council in New York, he made it his business to investigate what the sanctions were doing to the Iraqi people. He traveled to schools, hospitals, and visited people's homes. He saw the victims of the ongoing U.S.-British bombing, and he saw children dying of preventable diseases. Children are especially vulnerable to the contaminated water from water systems that were systematically destroyed by U.S. bombing. Today, an embargo on the needed supplies for water treatment prevents their repair. Hans von Sponeck was the fifth coordinator of the Oil for Food program since the operation began in December 1996, and, after Dennis Holliday, the second coordinator to resign in protest. He now travels internationally, speaking in churches and schools, appealing for compassion and understanding of the plight of an innocent Iraqi population. Last week you heard his talk at a college and the beginning of the question period. Today you will hear a conversation we had when we shared a meal. But before that, I want you to hear a couple more answers he gave to the college audience, beginning with the question, what caused you to resign from the Oil for Food program? Hans von Sponeck.
I would never have resigned because of U.S. or British pressure. Not at all. I resigned because of pressure here. My conscience troubled me. If you are every day associated with this kind of a program, then you become part of the problem. And I could not accept that. So for that reason, I resigned. I feel a very deep responsibility because I was one of very few people who had this experience. And to keep my mouth shut now would be doing a very wrong service to the UN, who must exist. Somebody said if the UN doesn't exist, we would have to invent it. I think the UN must exist, it must be strengthened, and I want to do everything I can to show that one can try and win a battle also with honest interpretation and constructive suggestions without that hidden agenda. What is so awful is that when you see a politician today, the first thing that comes to my mind, and I probably am poisoned for life now, reading newspapers, I don't trust anymore what I'm reading because there is so much organized lying. There is organized, it has nothing to do with the media. It has something to do with our political structure in Europe and here. I don't believe anymore when a politician says it's like this, because it is probably the opposite. So I'm trying to counterbalance this. Please.
What do you think about the government?
The question was, what do I think about Saddam Hussein's government? I met with everyone from Saddam Hussein down. Ministers, foreign affairs, trade and health were the three Iraqi ministers with whom I had to deal regularly because the Oil for Food program was their responsibility. Seriousness of purpose. They did not play with the destinies and lives of their people. Wait, and you will maybe forget me, long have forgotten me, when you still read in the press, the Iraq government is purposely withholding food and medicine from the people. We never, not one single time, did we have that reality. In fact, out of the 660 international staff that worked with me in Iraq, 300 or so had no other job but to go and travel around Iraq to verify that the items that came in reached the end destination. Health centers, schools, hospitals, electricity factories, whatever. And the picture was good.
That is Hans von Sponig answering questions from students at a California college in November of 2001. A young woman asked whether the Iraqis are angry at the American people. Here is his answer.
The potential for that is clearly there, and we see little signs of that. But on the whole, I could never understand, and I was deeply impressed by the fact that the Iraqis as individuals make a difference between criticizing a policy of a country and appreciating or condemning individuals from that country. In January of 99, the silent, not much reported bombing that occurs over Iraq on average once every 3 days now and for the last few years. One missile or two missiles went astray in southern Iraq and killed 17 people in two neighborhoods. So I went there to look at that and to understand whether the Iraqi news agency had exaggerated or whether what I was told was correct. Well, to my surprise, I personally counted 17 coffins, not 11 coffins, as reported by the Iraqi news agency. That's not why I'm telling you the story. I'm telling you the story because as I went there, I took with me my security chief, an Indian gentleman. And here was a crowd of people protesting in the neighborhood where this had occurred to give me a message. And he came to me and whispered into my ear, if this would be in India, and we as two foreigners, an Indian and a German, they would shred us to pieces, he said. The public anger would be so strong. It wasn't there like that. They protested, and then when they had protested, and they came, they were curious, they talked. That's Iraq. These are Iraqis. Iraqis are magnanimous. Iraqis are kind people.
Hans von Sponig. And the last question was, will the U.S. government go to war against Iraq?
I personally think everything is ready for that. Will it happen? Maybe not. Why not? I don't think because there's a reluctance in the minds of Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Wolfowitz, the Secretary of Defense and his deputy, but because of pressure. Pressure from here, from the people in America, which is not very strong yet, but more pressure from the Middle East, more pressure from the countries in the Middle East. The Secretary General of the group that is called the Arab League has just a couple of days ago appealed to the U.S. government not to do this for fear that the Middle East may be burning when you do that. So I hope we will not see more innocent lives lost because of unfinished business to be finished. But at this moment, all I can see and say, aircraft carriers, troop deployments, planes going to the Arabian Sea and to the Persian Gulf, they're not going there for Afghanistan. Afghanistan is already in rubbles. So this deployment points clearly towards Iraq, and I hope Iraq will be spared. Thank you very much.
That was Hans von Sponig, former coordinator for humanitarian aid for Iraq, receiving a big round of applause from college and high school students. Von Sponig resigned in protest from the Oil for Food program that he administered for almost 2 years. We drove him to his third talk of the day at Stanford University and had a meal on the way. We sat outdoors in the courtyard of a hotel. At the beginning of his talk, Hans von Sponig had briefly mentioned that the death of his father had influenced his life. So, somewhat haltingly, I asked him about his father. This question actually has nothing directly to do with where we just were, although you did mention your father. What happened to your father?
Yeah, I'm sorry that I let go there, but my father was executed by the Hitler government. And he was a general in the German army. He disobeyed. He was court-martialed. he was sentenced to death penalty.
My mother appealed.
The death sentence was changed. He was jailed. And when the coup against the Hitler government failed, he had 3 hours before he was shot. That was my father's story. And I just thought I wanted to tell this to the students so that they realized where I was coming from, why I joined the UN, why I did what I did, and maybe there's no better role model for me than my father. So that's it. That's the answer.
You were young.
I was 6 when my father died. I was not quite 6. I was 5 and a little bit. But a young boy, such dramatic events, you remember. I remember going with my mother to jail to see him.
So your father actually, in what he did, preceded the resistance.
He was in charge of an army corps in southern Russia. And the winter of 41 was a very bitter winter. And he saw the Russian troops encircling the area where he was from the water. This was in the Crimean Kerch Peninsula area. And he asked for permission to withdraw his troops. And Hitler refused. And he asked again, and it was refused. He asked a third time, and it was refused. And then he decided that he would just cut communications with Berlin and withdraw 120,000 soldiers. And today, military historians confirm that my father's decision was absolutely, militarily, the right decision. But from a point of view of conscience, it certainly was the right decision. You know? And for that, he was punished. And then a very erratic government decided to change after my mother appealed. And then it ended in 44 when the plot against Hitler, the Stauffenberg coup, failed and I lost my father.
So a lot of people are alive today because of your father's decision.
Oh, I don't want to say that, but certainly this was a correct decision, and it posed the dilemma for any military leader, and that is, where does obedience end and your conscience begin? And that was his dilemma.
When you were asked to take Dennis Holliday's job after he resigned, what was the process by which you decided to take his job?
I knew him for many years, and we were friends, and I understood his dilemma. It was a very tough assignment. I was under no illusion there. But even though his briefing was so good, I didn't realize how inadequate a program the Oil for Food program really was, and what kind of obstacles I would face, managerial obstacles also, from the UN in New York. We were worlds apart, the UN in Baghdad and the UN in New York. And I know that if people in New York will hear me, they will say this is an unfair comment, but I'll say it. Compassion was in Baghdad. Compassion was certainly not in the UN Secretariat. The Oil for Food program is inadequate from every angle you look at it. It was also never meant to last that long, because the UN resolutions refer to it as a supplementary and temporary program. Supplementing, you can only supplement if there's something to supplement to, and there was very, very little of that. And temporary, I don't think after 5 years this is still the proper term to use. There was a wall of misleading approaches on the part of the Security Council. The Security Council simply was not honest, and that means the US and Britain in particular. They played games with people. They fought a political battle on the back of the Iraqi people. They know very well from the reports that we have submitted what the human condition is in Iraq. If you, despite that, continue then I think you can rightly be accused of playing a game on the back of the people. And this is what I objected to, and this is what ultimately led me to decide I cannot be associated with a program which is faulty by intention. Iraqis are really getting a double dose here. They're getting it from within by a government that is dictatorial, and they're getting it in an immense disproportion now also from outside through a clearly wrong policy. One day when the players that are currently involved are gone, there will be no more difficulty to recognize this. Right now, one can have only one healthy reaction to that is, and fight it.
You left out of your talk today, your meeting with Saddam Hussein. You said you met the ministers. Saddam Hussein asked to see you after you resigned.
That's correct. I had resigned. I was still 2 days in Baghdad. I met him. Well, I want to leave him out because he is such a special category, and I was never in a position where I negotiated with him, or this was not my role. This was also not possible. I could not have influenced him. I take him with all his shortcomings as given. He is a reality in Iraq over which I have absolutely no control. But I have control over that which is coming in from outside. So my concern is the sanction issue and the impact of an unreasonable policy. And I keep arguing lawlessness of one kind does not justify lawlessness of another kind. And we are involved in a severe case of illegality. We are violating the Convention on the Rights of the Child. We are violating the UN Charter. We are violating the Hague Convention. All that which has been created to protect people, we are pushing in the Security Council into a corner and disregard. And that makes the statement that today the UN has become a perpetrator in wrongdoing against the people of Iraq, not a fanatical or unreasonable or naive statement, but a factual statement which has been documented by people who look at it from a very unemotional point of view. I look at it, having lived there, from an emotional point of view also. But people like Professor Boissot, who is a member of the Belgian Supreme Court, and others who have looked at it from a purely international legal perspective, come to this conclusion in very clear terms. So,
the situation is really incredibly bizarre, because among the critics of the Security Council are as well branches of the UN.
That's correct. And indirectly, because the reports by the World Health Organization, by UNICEF, and by UNDP, and by the Office of the Humanitarian Coordinator in Baghdad are making a very clear statement. The message is there. It is sanctions. It's not the behavior of a brutal government that is to be blamed for what we see now in Iraq. So it's no longer a question of is it so or is it not so. The evidence is there, and that evidence is to a large extent simply ignored by the U.S. government and by the British government.
Now, all your work currently traveling is really dedicated to alleviating the sanctions. However, we are living at a time where we are asking ourselves who else will get drawn into the war, and you alluded to it as well, how this massing of troops and military equipment in that area may also be directed against Iraq. What are your fears at this point for your work and for Iraq?
Iraq is now targeted, and targeted without having the evidence. And if the evidence exists, then I think in a democracy, governments owe it to the people to divulge that evidence. I have seen only conjecture. I've seen only people who have an axe to grind, who want to finish unfinished business, to suggest that Iraq is responsible for any international act of terrorism and the Anthrax disaster in the U.S. And until such time that there is such evidence, I think Iraq should be left alone. And if Iraq is a perpetrator of this, obviously no one in his right mind or her right mind would argue that they shouldn't be brought to justice. But the emphasis is in bringing the perpetrators to justice, not condemning a whole nation to further suffering. Let me at least mention once the word ethics. I hope that in the Defense Department of the United States is also an element of ethics left. This is unethical to start targeting a nation on the basis of conjecture. And if there is evidence, not to limit it to the perpetrators, but go beyond that. And this is bound to happen. With this kind of might that is assembling in the Gulf, in the Arabian Sea, it doesn't augur well for me. And I hope that the public conscience in the United States and elsewhere will speak out against that, and the Security Council will object to giving an extension of the right to attack that they had given under Article 51 of the UN Charter to the operations in Afghanistan, that they will withhold this kind of extension to Iraq.
I was interested in hearing that you actually spent 10 years in Pakistan in Mujahideen-held areas. Is there something in your memory, your experience, that helps us understand what's going on between Pakistan and Afghanistan today?
You see, the northwest frontier province of Pakistan is peopled mainly by Pashto-speaking groups, the same groups who live and have the same language on the other side of the border. The Taliban are mostly Pashto. 60% of the Afghan population, in fact, is Pashto. Pakistan has always had a very deep concern over the relationship with Afghanistan because of the fear that the Pashto-speaking groups on both sides of the border might get together and establish Pashtunistan, an independent entity, political entity. And this whole conflict, this whole potential danger, played also into the relationship between Pakistan and India, because India, of course, knows this and wants to play a role in Afghanistan as well in order to have an ally there. So there was this silent or less silent tug of war between Pakistan and India over the relationship of the two countries to Afghanistan. And that makes this whole conflict in Afghanistan now so complicated. And what President Bush indicated when he said they are either for us or against us is an enormous simplification, because a man like President Musharraf in Pakistan cannot possibly take just one side in this conflict.
The contradictions that exist now between India and Pakistan and Afghanistan are somewhat being exploited at this point.
The thoughts go beyond the immediate confrontation into helping to build a longer-term alliance of different ethnic groups in Afghanistan to prevent sliding back into another Taliban-type reality. And this will require an immense amount of understanding of the ethnic picture in Afghanistan. The solution will not be by welding at all costs such an alliance from outside. The alliance must be an alliance from within. The Afghans must be given a chance without outside interference, and God forbid, without outside bribery, as we have seen too often in there will not be a political solution. The concept of the lawyer jirga, a traditional Afghan concept of conflict resolution, elders getting together to discuss their future, is a good concept, is a strength of that society. But you cannot, from outside, as has been tried in the late 80s by Pakistan and by the Americans, you cannot hope to succeed, because that's artificial. You must leave it to the Afghans. You must let them decide who participates there, and then maybe you have a chance for something more permanent.
That was a conversation with Hans von Sponeck, the former humanitarian coordinator for the Oil for Food program for Iraq. When he resigned in protest from his position, he ended a 32-year career with the United Nations. Now he travels and talks to help end the sanctions and to help prevent a looming second war on Iraq. I emailed him to let him know that this program was going out, and he wrote back, January 4, 2002, there is no breaking news from my end, except fear that an unreasonable Washington may go ahead in attacking Iraq in the name of fighting terrorism without any evidence that Iraq was involved. The latest revelations about anthrax and Doug Way are yet another indication of the extent to which the public has been fed with misleading information about Iraq. There are peaceful options to another Gulf War. A UN Secretary General brokered dialogue between the UN Security Council and the government of Iraq is one such alternative. I wish you all the best for the year ahead. Do let me know about the program you are about to air, and also reactions from the public to it. Yours, Hans von Sponeck. This was a one-hour talk and interview with Hans von Sponeck. Please let me know what you think about this program, so I can pass on your comments. You can leave messages on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Go to the contact page. Find out more about Hans von Sponeck on the newest program section on www.tucradio.org. You can get a copy of the full one-hour program with Hans von Sponeck for $12. That includes shipping. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Moriah Gelardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.